Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ, and my newsmaker today is San Diego County Sheriff Bill Gore, our region's top cop, and he's got a big beat to cover, more than 4,200 square miles. He's been sheriff since 2009, served in law enforcement for over 40 years. He worked as a special agent at the FBI on task force handling cyber crimes and terrorism. He also worked as a chief investigator and special advisor for the district attorney's office and as the undersheriff before he was elected sheriff. Welcome to the show, Sheriff Gore.
Thanks, Miriam. Good to be here.
Now, I understand some congratulations are in order to your department. Deputy Michael Spears was awarded the Medal of Valor by Governor Brown last week for saving two deputies during a shootout in Lakeside.
Yeah, it was a nice recognition by the state. That was obviously a really traumatic incident. Deputy Ali Perez is still off work from recovering from his injuries, and Deputy Craig Johnson, fortunately, has recovered and back to work. But we're lucky that we didn't lose a deputy on that day, and a lot of it was due to the great work of Mike Spears.
Well, we certainly all appreciate them working to keep people safe, and we certainly wish Deputy Perez all the best on his completion of his recovery. Now, today we're here to talk about crime and specifically prison realignment. California, as many of you listeners may know, has been under orders for the last 2 years from a federal court. It's gone all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've ordered the state to ease prison overcrowding, which means cutting down the inmate population to 137% of capacity. Now, the state already has sent some prisoners back to local jurisdictions, and there's going to be another wave of that now as the last round of appeals have run out. Sheriff, can you bring us up to date on the latest happenings in Sacramento?
What really happened with criminal justice realignment was that, as you pointed out, the Supreme Court, or the three-judge panel and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, ordered California to lower its capacity. That equated to about downsizing over a two-year period of about 40,000 state inmates. Mm-hmm. The way the state came up in what they call criminal justice realignment, instead of releasing or just taking 40,000 inmates and transferring them to county jails, what they said was that starting October 1st of 2011, if you were sentenced in the state of California for a nonviolent, non-serious sex offense, instead of going to state prison, you went to a county jail. Prior to that, if you were sentenced to a year or less, you went to a county jail, no matter what the offense. If you were sentenced to a year or more, any felony, you basically went to state prison. Well, that all changed. And when they looked through all their records and the type of inmate they had in state prison, they felt that over a two-year period that they had to implement realignment and to downsize their system, that would equal out to about downsizing to 40,000 inmates. Well, what's happened here? We're coming up on the two-year anniversary, December 31st of this year, when it's their deadline to downsize, and they're about 9,000 to 10,000 inmates short. So they've downsized the state prison system by 31,000 inmates. So what the state went in and asked the three-judge panel to give them a three-year extension.
But I understand that the court turned around and said, "No thanks.
No,
thank
you.
That."
They said, "We're not going to give you the extension." So the next plan was, okay, if you're not going to give us an extension, what we would like to do is to get the last 1,000 inmates, not do an early release of 9,000 inmates, but contract with county jails that had space available to put some of these state prisoners in county jails, and also contract with private prisons out of state to handle the remainder of the inmates.
Correct.
They felt between those two combinations, they could downsize by the end of the year by that 9,000 inmates necessary. Well, the three-judge panel came back and said, okay, we'll give you not a three-year extension. We're going to give you a one-month extension, and we're not going to allow you to contract with out-of-state private prisons, but you can contract with local county jails.
So what can they do realistically in 30 days? Is there anything?
Well, the governor is going to appeal that decision. Mm-hmm. I personally and the state sheriffs as an organization and the district attorneys, probation officers, we all agree with the governor. I think the three-judge panel has gone outside the scope of their authority here. Their mission was to downsize the prison system. Now, how the state does that, whether they ship them to out-of-state private prisons or do it with county jails, seems to be beyond the scope of their responsibility.
Are they concerned about the conditions in some of those private prisons? Certainly, we've seen the ACLU, some others complain about inhumane conditions.
I don't know what they base their decision on, to be quite honest with you, Miriam. I disagree with it. If their decision stands, all the figures I've looked at show that we can, in the state of California, there's about 5,000 beds available in county jails.
And how many are available in San Diego County?
Absolutely none.
So we're full.
We're full. We're over full. We're at about 102 to 104% of capacity. So in reality, what we're going to end up with is about 4,000 inmates, probably, if the three-judge panel doesn't let us ship those out of state. Now they're going to have to be released early.
Now, you've had some experience with this already with the first wave of realignments. I understand you've been very proactive in how you've dealt with this. Can you tell us about some of the things you've put in place with this first wave of realignment? And also, for all the fear that this would increase crime, has that actually happened with the first wave of prisoners that were released early?
Two-part question. I want to correct so your viewers understand. Nobody's being released early. What's happening, instead of inmates serving their sentence in state prisons, when they're sentenced, they now go to county jails. We have not released any of these realigned inmates early.
Okay.
So,
are you having to release any of the lower level offenders that were in the county jail to begin
Population, some of our old misdemeanor population, we've applied up to 10% credits to their sentences so they get out a little earlier. But when you look at the average sentenced inmate in our system served about 65 days, that equates maybe to 6 days or 10 days off their sentence.
Yeah, so it's not that
It's not that significant. And these are the old population, the least serious of the, of the violators. What we, as an organization here in San Diego, which these citizens of San Diego County should be very proud the way their public safety officials approach this. When this came down, we didn't ask for it. We fought it. But let's face it, this is reality. It's a law. Mm-hmm. And we have to implement it to keep the citizens of San Diego County safe. So what we did is we said, okay, how are we going to accomplish this? How are we going to make this work? And we looked at what do we want to accomplish. And if we're not going to have the same problems that the state had with overcrowding and a 72% recidivism rate, mm-hmm. which is what the state had.
Staggering. What is the national rate, do you know?
It's a lot lower than that, I guarantee. So we had one of the highest in the nation.
Why is the state so high?
Well, because they just warehouse people. When you were sent to a state prison, you were sent for, anywhere from a year to 10 years, there was no rehabilitation mm-hmm. programming in the facilities. They were overcrowded. Basically, every square foot that you might have had a classroom or drug treatment program in was taken up with a bunk bed.
So if you could give advice to the governor, based on what you've done here, and we want to hear more about that, what advice would you give him on how to reduce the state's recidivism rate?
Well, the answer is you've got to do more than warehousing. And they're starting to do that now that they're developing more space in their facilities. It was a double whammy. They had no space, plus we had the Great Recession of 2008. So when the light went out at the state, we got to start doing more programming in our facilities. First of all, there was no room to do it. And then we had a $28 billion budget shortfall, which realignment helped to address. It took care of the overcrowding problem, or was meant to be. And then it also took care of the part of the $28 billion budget shortfall by putting this burden on the counties and really not giving us enough money to handle it. If we're going to be successful, we have to do programming and we have to lower that recidivism rate.
And when you say programming, give our listeners some examples.
Yes, programming is rehabilitation programming, whether it's the probably number one thing that our inmates need is substance abuse programming to get them clean and sober. Another big part of it is literacy programs, teaching them how to read or write. Anger management, all the programs that we can do for somebody to give them a chance of succeeding when they come out of our facility.
What about education and jobs?
Education programs, GED programs, getting them a high school diploma.
So they can get a job when they get out instead of going back to crime.
Our biggest challenge is finding people who will hire these inmates when they come out of our jails.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just sit there and warehouse them and then recycle them over and over and over again.
Is this something where if an employer is willing to do that, should they contact your office?
Absolutely. You know? And I realize, we all realize, there's some professions, there's some jobs where you can't hire an ex-felon
right.
to work in there. But there are jobs that these people can do, and if trained properly, they would be very thankful mm-hmm. and hopefully good employees. And trust me, we're not naive enough to think that if we do rehabilitation program in our facilities, we're going to turn all these people around.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
But we don't have to. If we just lower that recidivism rate from, let's say, 70% to 50%, we'll be a gigantic success. We will keep the crime yeah. rates down. And by the way, crime rates are down at almost a 30 to 35-year low yeah. right now.
Now, for those who might say, well, gee, I don't want to be coddling criminals, spending money on these programs, does it work out to be less money in the long
sure.
run to have these programs than to just build more
right.
prisons or jails?
I hear this all the time, Erin. I give my Rotary speeches, mm-hmm. and people say, you know, put them in jail and throw away the key. And for some offenders, the John Gardners of the world
sure.
that killed Chelsea and Amber, he'll never see the light of day, and that's
right.
fine. Put them in jail and throw away the key. But with the people in our community and have to realize that 95% of the people that go away to jails and prisons are going to come back, and they're going to come right back to our community. So doesn't it just make sense to maybe give them the tools so they have a chance of succeeding when they come out of jail and have some programming set up to transition them back to the community instead of just, you know, within a year to 2 years, rearresting them, putting them back in our facilities, to where we can continue to pay $40,000 to $50,000 a year to house them in there.
Certainly seems to make sense.
I mean, economically, it's crazy. And just the kind of a moral obligation we have to make some useful, good use of the time that they have in our facility.
Right.
Before we had realignment, the average sentenced inmate was 65 days. Now we think that average sentenced inmate is going to be anywhere from 1 to 3 years.
Wow, that's a lot.
Well, let's take advantage of that time.
Absorb.
Give them some tools so they can be productive citizens when they come back to our communities, and they're all coming back. So they don't have to burglarize your house or mine or steal our car
right.
to make a living.
Speaking of the crime, since the first wave of the prison realignment, those that you've had come back and some of the local offenders that have been released a little bit early, have you seen any measurable impact on the crime rate here in San Diego County?
Crime did tick up last year,
mm-hmm.
pretty much around the county, both on violent crimes and in property crimes.
Could you tie that to whether or not
no.
it was the reoffenders?
That's the whole thing. We're speculating now. We look mm-hmm. at, okay, well, what's changed? Well, realignment. I just think it's too early. We're watching it very closely.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to put our head in the sand on this
right.
issue. But I think it's too early to tell. And we had realignment in California, but crime went up all over the United States. And they didn't
so
have realignment.
So it could just be a recession.
So I think yeah. Personally think a lot of it's related to the recession,
mm-hmm.
to the Great Recession that we're all living through,
mm-hmm.
to certain benefits running out, whether they be unemployment benefits, other social programs, and people having to support their family, support themselves, or put food in their mouths, which leads to, if you can't get a job, you're going to find it somehow, and that's either through a robbery, a burglary, or a theft of some
Something.
Sort. But we're watching it closely. Like I say, we don't want to be naive about this,
mm-hmm.
but for the first 6 months of this year, violent crime is down again.
Well, that's good news.
And property crime, except for non-residential burglaries, pretty much is down also. But it's something we constantly watch. I just think it's too early to attribute it to realignment.
The programs you've talked about, do you have some of those in effect now for some of the people that have been released? Or is that something new coming in the future?
No, absolutely. We've always done programming in a limited amount in our jails. We're expanding those. But again, you need room to do programming. We're running at 102% of capacity. We're adding space at our East Mesa Detention Facility and at the new Women's Detention Facility in East County in Santee. That will give us a lot of that room to do really effective reentry programs. We're going to be building classrooms. You have to have those facilities to do this type of programming. And yes, we are expanding that. And a real key part of this is to partner with community-based organizations. So we don't do what the
yeah.
state did and just kick them out, give them a bus ticket, say good luck. We want to transition them into, if they need it, a sober living bed in the community, a substance abuse program where they can continue in their sobriety. And again, that key part is maybe trying to find them a job. So when they leave our facilities, they go into some type of employment so they can support themselves or their family.
Very good. as we're taping this on Monday morning here, Congress is trying to decide whether or not to shut down the federal government or not. If that occurs, is that going to have an impact on local law enforcement or public safety, do you think?
I don't see if it's a short-term close, shutdown, a week, something like, I don't see any real impact on us.
That's good.
It will have an, well, sequester's already had an impact on us, really, from a public safety standpoint, because our partners in the federal level, and we partner like no other region of the country does with FBI, DEA, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol. Well, those people are all taking a furlough days. And so to the extent they're not there and have the amount of participation that we're used to, you know, that hurts us. A lot of the FBI employees will be exempted because they are considered essential personnel. But there are the professional staff that back them up that people forget about.
So they there might be a backlog in the paperwork.
Right, sure. So everything kind of slows down. They might not carry a gun and a badge, but they're the backbone of any operation. They, like they're at the Sheriff's Department. They support the gun carriers who are out there putting people in jail. And it just puts a monkey wrench in the whole criminal justice system. So if there is a shutdown, I certainly hope that the politicians come to their senses and it's a short shutdown.
There you go. Now, your office has gained fame for doing a lot with technology to help solve crimes and really do more with less in these tight budget times. Can you give us a few examples? And do you see some ways that technology might help you with monitoring some of these prisoners, for example,
sure, sure,
or helping to cut down on crime?
Just to address your last thing there, we need, if we're going to make this thing work, to free up jail beds, because we were short to start off with.
Sure.
Jail beds for people that really need to be behind bars. So one of the first things we did was set up an alternative custody program for our old inmates, our old misdemeanors.
And what are some of the kinds of inmates, misdemeanors we're talking about?
Oh, you know, a lot of your drug crimes are misdemeanors. Some
petty thefts,
small larcenies, white collar crimes, some are misdemeanors. So what we've done is come up with a program to identify the people that pose the least amount of risk to the community from a public safety standpoint. And we put them in an alternative custody program with an ankle bracelet. Maybe they're in their home or they're in a work furlough program to where they come and spend their nights in a work furlough bed, but then they go out and work. So they keep that job. So we freed up about 300 beds through our alternative custody program. On the law enforcement side, which is critical, our number one focus is intelligence-led or information-led policing. And all that sounds really fancy. What it means is taking advantage of the information age we live in, taking all that information that's out there now, thank God, in a digital format, taking information we gather in our automated records management system, so crime stats are instantaneously available to us now, buying a criminal justice software so we can take all that information and get it to our people out in the field in a usable format to our patrol deputies so that they can hopefully be predictive instead of reactive. When there's a murder or there's a crime committed, we're great, and local law enforcement and cops and sheriffs are really good at responding and investigating that crime. What we want to do is try to be there ahead of that and be predictive and stop those crimes.
Makes sense.
A great example are residential burglaries. In the past, if you have a residential burglar, a prolific burglar, you're going to unfortunately probably catch him on the 18th, the 25th burglary.
In La Mesa, when my house was burglarized, they didn't even take fingerprints back then. Even though the guy dropped the knife in the bedroom on the way out the window, they wouldn't even take fingerprints.
What we're trying to do now, using all this information technology, looking at patterns and scientific advances, DNA primarily, to try to catch that residential burglar on the second burglary instead of the 20th and keep crime rates down. DNA has been a great, great help in that area.
Okay.
Everybody thinks of DNA solving the murder and the rape and the blood and the semen and all that. The biggest beneficiary of advanced DNA technology and our ability in our lab to get DNA from smaller and smaller specimens is in the area of property crimes.
Very interesting.
Burglaries, car thefts. We get what they call contact DNA.
Interesting.
You get DNA out of a fingerprint.
You know, you set up the high-tech forensic crime lab here in San Diego.
And then we had Prop 69 back in 2004, which took a state database of identified DNA from a quarter of a million to up over 3 million specimens now. So as that database grew, so we know who that DNA belongs to, and our ability to extract DNA from smaller and smaller specimens, we're solving crimes that we've never solved before. 400 or 500 crimes that we're solving every year that never would have been solved through DNA. So that's how we're catching that burglar on the second burglary instead of the 25th burglary.
Now, as we approach the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire, one issue that's very much on the minds of East County residents and really people all over San Diego County is, are we safer than before or not? What is happening with the inmate fire camps, and what impact is the state realignment having on that? Are we safer or less safe?
The first part, we are safer. Law enforcement and public safety is better prepared than we've ever been. Our communications are better. We've done, I think, a good job in a lot of areas of brush removal. Probably could always do more, but that's kind of resource-driven.
Improving alerts, certainly.
Realignment has had an undesired effect on some of the state fire camps. The type of inmate that staffs these state fire camps are now in county jails, the nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offenders.
So they can't send them out to the fire camps
anymore? Well, now they're in our county jails, and the state says, well, you know, we need some of those inmates to staff our fire camps. We said, you know, we'd be willing to work with them and give them to the state. But now the state says, but if you're going to give them to us, you have to pay us because that's your inmate.
Wow.
So it's a real catch-22. They created the problem. They gave us the inmate that they normally would have had in their fire camp. And if we want to give them to the fire camp, protect our backcountry, we have to pay the state to take their prisoners they used to have.
Is the county able or willing to make those payments? Or what's going to happen?
Yeah, in spite of the catch-22 part of it and how bad it irritates me, our bottom line is we got to keep this county safe. We've entered into a contract with State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. We've come up with the money, and we will pay the state to take some of these inmates so these fire camps can be staffed. The maximum I think we'll be able to squeeze out of our San Diego County population is about 100 inmates.
So does that mean we're going to have a lower population total at these fire camps then?
I'd have to look and see what the state numbers are, but I think that's what I've heard from the state is they're really having a difficult time staffing a lot of these camps.
So very troubling.
Yeah, it's very troubling. But we're working with them. We've got an MOU with the state. We're going to be taking our inmates, putting them in the fire camps under the supervision of CDCR.
Is it time maybe to reopen some county fire camps with some of the local low-level offenders?
We run into a lot of those same problems. What we're looking at is maybe entering into agreements with Public Works so that they're out there doing a lot of brush removal. Anytime we can keep our inmates busy doing something instead of just sitting in a cell, everybody wins.
Yeah, I've actually talked to inmates who've been through these honor camps, they called them way back when, and they actually said they liked it better than sitting in a cell.
Sure. But the inmates, our inmate population is changing. We have a higher risk offender than we did in the past.
So these may not be the kind of people you want to just be out in an area where they could run off.
Yeah, you don't want these people, a lot of them out in the backcountry, unsupervised or with minimal supervision. So it's a constant balancing act that we're trying to do between keeping our backcountry safe and the fire dangers we live through here on a regular basis and the risk these people pose to public safety when they're out in the community. So we're working with the state. Probably there's only a couple of counties now in the state out of 58 that have entered into a contract. We're one of them. Diane Jacob, Supervisor Jacob, has been a good partner in working with us to make this happen.
Well, it's good to hear that you're being proactive about that. And Sheriff, we certainly appreciate you coming on the show today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know or anything that listeners out there can do to help your office keep everyone safe?
Well, there's so many things. You know, we talk about it. We just talked about fires. There's, you know, clearing the area around your home to keep your particular home safe and have that setback from the shrubbery and the brush that's out there. This is all of our responsibility. Beyond the fire danger, what you can do to help us, volunteer, be involved. Get involved in neighborhood watches. Criminals like nothing more than a neighborhood full of strangers to where nobody knows anybody else. It's better when you have that sense of community and you watch out for each other, either through community watch programs. There's different things you can go online now and sign up for with different departments to be a part. You can volunteer with the sheriff's department or most local law enforcement agencies. We have 700 senior volunteers
That's
in the
great.
Sheriff's department. Our search and rescue team is all staffed with volunteers.
And they're amazing.
150 people. There's a lot of ways that you can get involved and make San Diego County a safer place to live. My goal, and I said this when I ran back in 2009, was to make San Diego County the safest urban county in the United States. And we're not far from meeting that goal. And it's not just me. It's not the cops. It's this sense of community that we all have, and the community and the citizens working with law enforcement and making this really a team effort.
Well, very good. We certainly appreciate you coming on the show today, and thank you very much, Sheriff Gore, for
Thanks,
joining
Mary.
Us here.
We could have made this a four-hour show, I think.
I think we could have, and we certainly look forward to having you back in the future. Anytime there's something that you want to talk about or want our listeners to know, you're welcome back anytime.
Good. Thanks, Mary.
Sheriff's Deputy Michael Spears and San Diego Police Officer Michael DeWitt risked their lives to save two deputies who were shot by a child molestation suspect in Lakeside in September of 2012. The wounded deputies, Ali Perez and Craig Johnson, both survived, thanks to their colleagues' heroism. So on September 26th, Governor Jerry Brown and Attorney General Kamala Harris presented the Medal of Valor, California's highest law enforcement award, to Deputy Spears and Officer DeWitt for their courage above and beyond the call of duty. Governor Brown said, quote, "Character, leadership, and being able to act in difficult and uncertain circumstances, that's what we honor today." Attorney General Kamala Harris called the officers true heroes. Spears said that his greatest honor, however, is knowing that Deputy Perez and Sergeant Johnson are alive and doing well. Perez surprised Spears by attending the award ceremony, which took place a day after the one-year anniversary of that terrifying event. They commemorated the occasion by having dinner together. Officer Johnson was traveling and wasn't able to attend, but he was present in spirit, Spears said. Here's what happened during their harrowing ordeal, according to authorities. On the day of the shooting, Deputies Perez and Johnson knocked on the door of the suspected child molester. When no one answered, they kicked in the door. Perez was shot and Johnson returned fire, but was also struck. Spears was outside when he heard the shots. He shielded Johnson with his body and pulled him out of the apartment, then kicked in a next-door neighbor's door where they sought cover from the gunfire. He also helped cover another officer who went in to rescue Perez. Later, when the wounded suspect crawled out of the apartment, Spears and another deputy held him at gunpoint. Spears said he just followed his training. Quote, "I did what anyone who didn't want to die would do. I didn't want my friends to die," he said. San Diego Police Officer Michael DeWitt with the Gang Suppression and SWAT Unit was driving to work when he heard the shootout and could see chaos in the apartment complex. He pulled over and put his tactical gear on. Then he ran to assist a group of deputies and assembled a team to rescue Perez. A panicked woman with two small children was running from the apartment right in the shooting suspect's line of fire. DeWitt ran toward her and picked up her four-year-old child. She ran, carrying her infant as he led the family across the street. Then Officer DeWitt ran back to help deputies rescue Johnson and Spears, who were still in the apartment next door. The local officers were among 14 honored with the Medal of Valor, including a California Highway Patrol officer who climbed a bridge and saved a suicidal man, hanging on despite being stabbed repeatedly. In addition, 11 officers from the Modesto Police Department received the award for saving fallen comrades from a gunman. For KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Ed Barena.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson with the Local Government Report. From PACE programs to pine cones, there's a lot that's hot on local agendas this week. On Tuesday, October 2nd, the Lemon Grove City Council will consider a resolution to join the California HERO program, a property-assessed clean energy PACE financing program to help homeowners install home energy efficiency upgrades such as solar.
Lemon Grove's council will also receive presentations from experts on homelessness, including data, trends, and best practices for Lemon Grove and the San Diego region.
In addition, Lemon Grove council members will take public testimony regarding potential uses of community development block grants, known as CDBG grants.
On Wednesday, the Lakeside Community Planning Group will hear presentations from county staff on a plan to underground electric, telephone, and cable TV lines between Woodside Avenue and Mapleview Street, along with removing 36 utility poles from sidewalks on Main Street.
In addition, Lakeside's agenda includes a discussion and vote on a conceptual plan for a proposed East County Equestrian Center at Willow Road and Moreno Avenue, as well as a proposed cell tower at Lakeside Fire Station Number 3 on Highway 8's business loop.
Now, Lakeside planners are also going to vote on whether to remove a mature bunya tree behind the library that is reportedly creating a safety hazard with falling pine cones weighing up to 20 pounds.
You know, the bunya tree, there have been fossils found all the way back to the Jurassic era, and they can grow to 45 feet tall, and they have pine cones the size of footballs.
Wow. Well, watch out if you're walking near that lakeside library then, folks. Be careful of those bunya-bunya cones. I understand the Aborigines used to use them as food and for trading. Is that right?
Actually, they would trade bunya-bunya nets for fish with tribes that lived down near the ocean, much like the Kumeyaay trade with the desert dwellers for food that's grown out in the desert.
Fascinating. Well, if they do decide to cut that tree down, maybe they'll have a bunya-bunya pinecone feast out there in Lakeside. With that, this concludes our local government report for this week.
You're listening to the Voices of East County, sponsored by East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM, live from Descanso.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM in Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
On Tuesday, October 1st, the California Public Utilities Commission will hold hearings in San Diego to decide who should pay for the costs of the now closed down San Onofre nuclear generating stations, ratepayers or utility companies. The hearings will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. on October 1st and again from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. that night at the Al Bar Shriners Auditorium in Kearney Mesa. The Coalition to Decommission San Onofre contends that San Diego Gas and Electric Company and Southern California Edison knew about design flaws in replacement steam generators when the plant was shut down on January 31st, 2012, and that after an analysis was completed in May of 2012, it should have been, quote, clear to any reasonable manager that the plant would never run again. In a press release, the group states, allowing investors to be risk-free in their investment continues to incentivize monopoly utilities to develop failed projects that run only for a short time. The coalition is asking the Public Utilities Commission to make SDG&E refund money paid by ratepayers after the shutdown. By contrast, SDG&E wants ratepayers to foot that bill. The Coalition to Decommission San Onofre counters, quote, ratepayers who fund their lavish compensation can barely support ourselves, our families, and our small businesses. They cite some evidence. The Houston Chronicle reported that the average annual compensation of utility executives nationwide increased 150% from 2000 to 2011. In Southern California, the annual compensation for the chairman and CEO of Southern California Edison rose 15 times during that decade to $10.9 million, while SDG&E's chairman and CEO quadrupled pay to $3.9 million. SDG&E and Southern California Edison ratepayers pay among the highest electricity rates in the nation. Edison is reporting a 43% increase in year-to-date core earnings this year over last year. SDG&E's parent, Sempra Energy, owns a 20% share in the San Onofre nuclear facility, and SDG&E reported a profit in its second quarter this year that nearly quadrupled over last year.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. A world-famous gambler and poker player known for the largest and longest documented winning streak in gambling history has been charged in a card-marking scheme at Barona Casino, the district attorney's office announced. He reportedly cheated the casino out of more than $8,000. Ana Yeros Carabiniotis, 62, also known as Archie Karras, was caught by the Barona Gaming Commission marking cards at the casino's blackjack table in July, the DA's office said. Karras was arrested at his Las Vegas home on Tuesday and will be extradited to San Diego to face charges of burglary, winning by fraudulent means, and cheating. District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis said, this defendant's luck ran out thanks to extraordinary cooperation between several different law enforcement agencies who worked together to investigate and prosecute this case. The Nevada Gaming Control Board had previously investigated the notorious gambler on multiple occasions, resulting in four arrests. Karras is best known for his winning streak from 1992 to 1995, when he turned just $50 into $40 million. He went on to gamble away his fortune that same year. He is considered by many to have been the greatest gambler of all times and has often been compared to Nick the Greek, another high-stakes player. Karras himself claims to have gambled with more money than anyone else in history. The San Diego County, 18 federally recognized Indian tribes. San Diego County has 18 federally recognized Indian tribes and 10 Indian casinos, more than any other county in the United States. Nationwide, industry experts estimate that casinos lose tens of millions of dollars every year in various cheating scams. Cheating casinos also means cheating taxpayers, since Indian casinos contribute $7.5 billion each year to the California economy.
This is Miriam Raftery, and I've got some good news today for East County veterans. On last week's show, we reported that our investigation into county veteran services found that rural veterans were not getting their fair share of services. This matter was brought to our attention by Claudia Millerbragg, a reader who has been battling bureaucracy, trying to bring more veteran services representatives out to rural East County. East County Magazine's investigation found that veterans in wealthy coastal areas and North County communities have been getting better access to veteran services than those in rural areas or inner city communities. Wealthy places like La Jolla have veteran services representatives visit them 12 days every month. Claremont Mesa has services 5 days a week, while Oceanside, Escondido, and Chula Vista all have services anywhere from a dozen to 20 days every single month. There are also visits to coastal communities that are very close together, such as Carlsbad and Encinitas. And yet, in East County, there are no services at all east of La Mesa, and a representative only comes there on Fridays. That means a disabled veteran or any veteran in places like Jacumba, Borrego, or Julian could have a drive of 2 to 4 hours round trip or more in places that have no public transportation or where roads may not even be passable in winter weather. This is even more troubling and surprising because East County has the highest concentration of veterans in San Diego County, according to Supervisor Jacob. Now, after our story ran, Supervisor Jacob's office contacted us. A staffer informed us that Supervisor Jacob held a meeting last week with County Veteran Services and told them she wants more equitable staffing. The staffer informed East County Magazine that Supervisor Jacob plans to introduce a measure to the supervisors that would bring County Veteran Services representatives to county libraries throughout our region, including those most rural areas. The county representatives help veterans access services such as counseling, VA loans, educational, health, and job training benefits that are available to veterans. These are the men and women who served our nation honorably. Now they are hoping that the rest of the county supervisors will approve Supervisor Jacob's proposal when it's introduced and assure that our veterans will be treated with the honor and dignity that they deserve. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Thousands of whales, dolphins, and other sea mammals are getting a silent victory. A federal judge has ruled the National Marine Fisheries Service failed to protect the marine mammals from the Navy's use of sonar in their training exercises along the California coast. Hawk Rosales is with the Intertribal Sinkione Wilderness Council that represents 10 tribes in the Mendocino area. He says the current permits allow the Navy to conduct training exercises that can harm marine mammals and disrupt their migration, breeding, or feeding.
Science tells us that they are being impacted, and studies show that there have been many casualties from marine mammals because of the sonar.
The judge found the agency failed to use the best available science to assess the impacts of sonar to whales and other marine mammals. The federal agency must now reassess its permits to ensure the Navy's training activities comply with the Endangered Species Act. Rosales says protecting sea mammals protects tribal culture.
Because tribal culture recognizes those kinds of creatures as being extremely important historically and spiritually and in many, many ways to tribal peoples.
Steve Mashuda is an Earth Justice attorney representing the Coalition of Conservation and Northern California Indian Tribes.
What we've been advocating for the agency to do is to take this new information it has about the extent of the harm and where these whales are at certain times of the year, and to put in place some time and place restrictions on training exercises within certain areas.
The coalition did not ask the Corps to halt the Navy's exercise in this training range, but to require the agency to reassess the permits using the latest science and to order the Navy to stay out of biologically critical areas, at least at certain times of the year. This is Lori Abbott, California News Service.
This is a special announcement from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts. Community leaders and Cedar Fire survivors will dedicate a historic memorial to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the worst wildfire in California history. The ceremony will take place on October 26th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at River Park Fire Station in Lakeside. The event will also honor first responders and celebrate fire survivor families' lifelong connection as guests pause to reflect, remember, and reconnect. There will be exhibits, disaster prevention program information, book signings by Sandra Younger, the author of The Fire Outside My Window, a VFW band, food and beverages, a moment of remembrance, and appreciation for community support. Speakers will include Supervisor Diane Jacob, Fire Chief Andy Parr from Lakeside, David Castle from the Cedar Fire Rebuilding Resource Group, and presentations will be made from the offices of Senator Joel Anderson, Assemblyman Brian Jones, and Congressman Duncan Hunter. The Cedar Fire was the largest wildland fire in California history. It started 25 miles east of San Diego in the Cleveland National Forest when a hunter became lost and lit a small fire to signal for help on the evening of October 25th, 2003. It quickly spread out of control. By the time containment was declared on October 28th, the Cedar Fire had destroyed 280,278 acres, 2,820 buildings, and killed 15 people, nearly all of them in Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon. Damage occurred across the county, but nowhere was the toll more devastating than Lakeside, where the firestorm roared through the night, catching many people unaware of the approaching inferno. The Cedar Fire continues to hold the tragic record as the state's worst wildfire in total acreage burned, homes destroyed, and lives lost. For more information on the October 26th memorial event, you can visit www.lakesidefire.com. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. And now it's time for a Crime Beat report. Residents in Campo are voicing outrage after the state announced a plan to release a violent sexual predator from a mental hospital into the Campo community. 70-year-old Douglas Badger has been convicted of kidnapping and raping young men who were hitchhiking. He's also been convicted of sexually assaulting a 16-year-old girl. He has been diagnosed as a sexual sadist. He served several terms in prison and spent 18 years in a state mental hospital, but now the state thinks it's safe to let him loose. Claudia Millerbrag lives half a mile from where Badger is proposed to be released. She says, "A lot of my neighbors are outraged about this. We are tired of everything being dumped in East County. Powerlink, solar fields, wind turbines, and now violent offenders." Residents are organizing a protest at 6 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday in front of the home at 30033 Hartfell Road in Campo, where the state wants to release Badger. The site is just a block from a school bus pickup site and also close to schools. Supervisor Diane Jacob is also speaking out. She issued a press release which reads, "Given his violent history as a serial sexual predator, Douglas Badger forfeited his freedom long ago and should be locked up for good. Especially outrageous is that this vile man would be housed at a location in Campo that is only 4 miles from two schools and a mile from a park where children gather and play." Supervisor Jacob noted that in recent years, other sexual predators placed in rural East County have violated terms of their release and wound up sent back to a mental hospital. Rather than dumping Badger in the backcountry, the state should house him next to Donovan State Prison, where several sexually violent predators have previously been located, Jacob concluded. A hearing on Badger's proposed placement will be held on November 15th at 9 a.m. in San Diego Superior Court, Department 28 in downtown San Diego. Now, the public can also submit written comments between October 8th and 18th to sdsafe at doj.ca.gov. That's SDSAFE at DOJ, as in Department of Justice, .ca.gov. You can also send in written comments or speak at the hearing. For details on this, visit our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. Hi, this is Connie again, and I'm talking to you about what you should be thinking about planting now. And in another couple of weeks, you better not be thinking about it. You better be doing it. So what do we start with in the fall? You think green. Think of all those greens that you love to eat, because this is the time to get them in the ground. Asian greens, mustard greens, spinach, and my favorite, beet greens. Except you get a double payoff with beets. In fact, you get about a 5 or 6 payoff with beets, because every little beet seed that you are planting actually is an old dried up flower, and it contains 5 or 6 seeds in it. So when those beets come up, you've probably wondered in the past, why, if I only planted one beet there, do I have 5 little plants there? What you can do is wait until they get to be about 2 inches tall, and then, using your very most delicate touch, wet the soil and carefully, using your fingers on the leaves, pull out those extras. Leave the biggest one in place, pull the others, and immediately replant them 3 or 4 inches away from the mother plant, or start another row, but get them a ways away from each other so that they will each have room to grow. As they grow, you can enjoy pulling off an occasional big leaf and stir-frying it or cooking it up, braising it in a pan. They're my favorite greens, like I said. Eventually, much later, you will end up with full-grown beet roots that you can pull out and cook. So now's the time to start your beets. What else can you start now? Broccoli, everything in the cabbage family, kale plants. Pull the old ones from last year that are dried up over the summer. Get some new kale going. You can start cilantro now, and you will have to replant it again in about 2 months, because cilantro doesn't last forever. It goes to flower too soon. But at this time of year, with the cooler days and nights, it takes longer for it to bolt into flower. So cilantro is a great thing to grow right now. Right now, I just started my peas. I use Chinese edible pod peas, but any kind of peas can be started now. What you want to do is soak those seeds overnight or even for 48 hours and then plant them. Poke them into wet soil, get them down about 1 inch or so, 1.5 inches, cover them well. And I want to mention, when all these seeds that you plant, the smaller the seed, the closer to the surface you plant it. And always press down hard. Annie's Annuals up in Richmond is run by a delightful woman who talks about how she started her first batch of annual plants. She planted them outdoors in flats. The seed flats were right there. She was so upset because her cat ran across the seed flats when she was through planting them. What happened was those were the only seeds that came up. So that was a lesson to her, and it's a lesson to all of us. Press down on the soil after your seeds are in the ground so you have good contact as well as the moisture, so things will start early. You can grow radishes year-round. You can start scallions and green onions right now. Swiss chard. I would suggest that you get that in the ground right away, hopefully by the 1st of October, because Swiss chard likes the warm soil to start. In fact, all of these seeds like the warm soil to start, and then they appreciate the cooler days as they grow and get larger.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Richard Musio, co-author of The Rise, with best-selling author Greg Reed. The Rise is about collaboration and never giving up on one's dreams, which is an apt topic for our program. My guest is also a CPA and hosts It's Your Money and Your Life on 760 AM KFMB. Welcome, Richard. It's a pleasure having you here in the studio.
Thanks, Rainier. It's great to be here.
Let's start with your book, The Rise. How did your work as a CPA lead you to the theme of dreams, and how has writing this book been a part of your dream?
Well, as a CPA, I work with family offices, which are extremely high net worth families. And so we talk a lot about other forms of wealth besides money. We talk about people and knowledge. And the whole objective of the work that we do with these high net worth families is to try to ensure that all the family members thrive, not just financially, but also personally with regard to their education, their community involvement, whatever it is that interests them. And so the Rise, that was about collaboration and never giving up on your dreams. So it was really a discussion about other forms of wealth besides money and how people can do things that are meaningful in the community that go beyond, for example, just being focused on themselves.
So as a CPA, you were advising these families to not only increase their wealth, but also to improve the quality of their relationships and
improve
community.
Quality of relationships, but also make more meaningful contributions to their communities. And so to be able to do that, money certainly comes in handy, but frequently high net worth families have great resources that surround them in terms of intellectual capital, the people they know, their networks, their knowledge, their ability to do things and accomplish things. But many high net worth families think only about writing checks as opposed to actually rolling up their sleeves and getting involved in their community.
I see. So they're really adding to the whole quality of the community.
Exactly, as well as their own quality of life.
Your next book, I know, released this week. Congratulations. It has an intriguing title. So what's your play? How Billie Jean, Bobby, and Blindness Begat Tolerance. Tell us about this book and how it's connected to your life.
It's connected in many ways. 40 years ago in 1973, my job in high school, I grew up in the East County, Lakeside, went to El Capitan High. My job in high school was making scrapbooks for a famous tennis player named Bobby Riggs, who was during 1973 at the height of the women's liberation movement, the antagonist in two very famous tennis matches, one not as well remembered as the second. The first one was against the number one player in the world, Margaret Court, played up in Ramona at Country Estates, San Vicente, on Mother's Day of 73. And then 4 months later, the match that almost everybody remembers, known as the Battle of the Sexes, when Bobby Riggs played Billie Jean King, who at the time was the leading voice of all female athletes for the women's liberation movement. And my job was making scrapbooks for Bobby, created over 11 scrapbooks comprising over 2,500 pages of everything that was going on regarding those tennis matches in 1973. So the book is about that, and then it's also about what's happened in the ensuing 40 years after 1973.
So how did you get involved in doing their scrapbooks, and then how did that lead to the next 40 years?
Getting involved in the scrapbooks was by luck. My late father's only sibling, my aunt Marion, who we called Auntie Bun, married one of Bobby Riggs's older brothers. And in 1973, when Bobby thrust himself back in the public's consciousness, he needed a new scrapbook maker because I guess you could say he had become so much more public. Well, let's put it this way. He started cheating on his mistress, who was also his scrapbook maker.
Oh.
So she left him. So he also lost his scrapbook maker. And because I was a family member, I was called into action to sort of pick up the pieces.
It sounds like that one piece, so to speak, changed your life.
Absolutely changed my life. And then my book goes on to talk about looking back now 40 years in time from today backwards about the work that my foundation is doing. I went on to lose my eyesight in October of 2001, so I was blind for about a year before my eyesight came back. And when I came back, I reinvented myself as a long-distance endurance runner as opposed to what I was before, a tennis player, for my hobby. That led to the creation of my Move Your Feet Before You Eat Foundation, which now basically encourages healthy eating and physical activity in local communities here in San Diego. We are, in fact, expecting 15,000 people over Thanksgiving morning for the event we'll be doing in downtown Oceanside on Thanksgiving morning. So my joke is, if you think you have a lot of folks coming over for Thanksgiving, I probably have you beat.
So this is where they do the Oceanside Turkey Trot?
That's correct. It's known as the Oceanside Turkey Trot. It's bright and early Thanksgiving morning in downtown Oceanside. And again, we're expecting about 15,000 people in about 2 months. So very exciting stuff. But we basically encourage people to collaboratively get involved in their community, not only with health and fitness, but also with volunteerism.
So what are you working on next? What's your next book, and how does it tie into your past work and your foundation?
I have a chapter that's going to be in a book that's coming out in mid-October called Universal Wish. The foreword is by Frank Shankiewicz, the founder of Make-A-Wish Foundation. It's about how to make wishes or dreams come true. And again, it's sort of a story. It's going to be a chapter about how collaboration and how action, taking decisive action and always trying to progress with your own life, can make a big difference not only in your own life but the lives of other people as well.
Can you give us an example of a decisive action, something that you recommend for people to reach their dreams?
I think if people get involved in their community, they find that their life will be better. The themes of my book really are about taking action, but doing that collaboratively with others and trying to deploy that in your community to make a community a better place. I think people who are active in their community not only benefit their community, obviously, mm-hmm. but I think they also feel about themselves, mm-hmm. feel better about themselves. And I think ultimately to the degree that people who are different are working side by side to make their communities better, I think it breaks down the barriers that intolerance puts up, because when you're working side by side with people who might differ from you politically, sexually, race, mm-hmm. color, net worth, you know, income, whatever the case may be, I think you don't care about who sleeps with who or who voted for whom when you're working together on a common cause in your community. So I really think it serves to help break down some of these barriers that intolerance mm-hmm. tends to put up.
And your books have been collaborative as well.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any way to get a book done these days without some serious collaboration.
I agree with that. Well, congratulations. Look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, but thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Richard Muscio, please visit his website at www.iymoney.com, or you can email him at rjm@fabcpas.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is a public service announcement from CAL FIRE. CAL FIRE reminds you to properly store gasoline. Gasoline should only be stored in an approved safety can away from heat sources. Never store gasoline in the house, garage, or basement. Any spark or pilot light can quickly ignite fumes from gasoline. When invisible gasoline vapors explode, the intensity can engulf a garage with flames in seconds. Be fire safe, not sorry.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.